For 2 days, mainstream Christian leaders have criticised Donald Trump for using religion as a prop in his response to the violence that's shaken America. Since police in Minneapolis killed an unarmed black man, George Floyd, a week ago, protests and riots against police brutality have convulsed 350 cities. One of the arresting officers has been charged with George Floyd's murder. Donald Trump went first to an Episcopal church in Washington, D.C., where he waved around a Bible and vowed to crush protesters. Then he visited a shrine to Pope John Paul II. But the Episcopal and Catholic bishops have condemned the president. Washington, D.C.'s Catholic leader Wilton Gregory even called Trump's visit baffling and reprehensible. Jelani Cobb, Columbia University professor and New Yorker staff writer, has been watching the events unfold.
I mean, it was low-grade spectacle, which is what he specializes in. You know, ham-fisted, leaden symbolism. And that's what he got. He's famously ignorant of the Bible. And so when the question was raised to him, is that your Bible? He said, it's a Bible. And so the audience that respects him really was, you know, indulged, really was edified by that. But other people, you know, I think people who take democracy a little bit more seriously were horrified, because in order to have that photo op, he had the crackdown on peaceful protesters talking about the excesses of violence from the state. And by no measure would anybody think that these two things were compatible. I'm not sure if you saw, but the Archbishop of the diocese there, of that particular denomination, came out and denounced Trump's behavior. Lots of people from the denomination came out and denounced Trump's behavior, saying that what he had just done was antithetical to the teachings of the Bible.
Well, I think the bishop of the Episcopal Church in Washington even described it as bordering on the sacrilegious. But what right. message is he trying to send here, Jelani, by associating this brutal crackdown, and those protesters in Washington were very peaceful, associating his brutal crackdown with religion?
Well, I mean, he is hemorrhaging support right now. As you are likely aware, we have suffered terribly with the pandemic in this country and terribly from the recession. People are looking at him and thinking that he's inept. And so he is attempting to shore up. One of the more inscrutable things about 2016 was the extent to which evangelical Christians supported him, despite his questionable morality, straying from his marriage, the cheating on his wife with a pornography star a few months after the birth of their child, and all these things that don't seem to be in accord with what the religious right in this country believes, but they found a way to reconcile their beliefs with his character. And he's worried. He's even losing support because of the pandemic. He's even been losing support among evangelical Christians. And so I think this was just a really heavy-handed attempt to say, I'm your guy.
Pardon my innocence here. Do you still get votes with race baiting in the United States?
Well, the message is that you do, and that there's a lot of very fertile ground politically. We saw that in 2016. We've seen it subsequently. The politics of division, turning people against each other, making people fear Muslims, making people fear Latinos or undocumented immigrants, talking about crime in ways that don't correspond to the actual numbers and the plummeting numbers of crime in the United States in, you know, the past decade. All these things that have been centered, I think the common denominator for all of them is fear. He has been able to do that around issues of using racism very successfully, possibly the most successful race baiter in modern American politics.
When you think of a previous race baiter, I think, say, of George Wallace, a Democratic governor of Alabama. The funny thing was that in the latter years of his life, George Wallace repented of his racism. And I think in the last couple of elections that he faced, got a slight majority of the black vote in Alabama. Do you ever sense even the capacity for a similar style change in Donald Trump?
I don't think so. one of the reasons is that Wallace, even at his kind of worst race-baiting self, he was always cognizant of exactly what he was doing. Donald Trump is a different character. He seems not really intelligent enough to know that the things that he's doing or saying are not true. And he has a kind of inverse reasoning, which is that if he believes it, it must be true, as opposed to finding out that something is true and then believing it. Finally, when he was being interviewed in 2016 by Rick Warren, this is another reason why the support of the evangelical Christians is a head scratcher. When Rick Warren, who's a huge evangelical pastor in California, interviewed Donald Trump and posed a question to him, he said, "Do you ever ask God for forgiveness?" And Trump responded to the effect that he doesn't do anything wrong. And so I think that actually makes him Jesus. I think that actually qualifies him as the savior. And if you're a person who believes that your own personal actions are infallible, that does not facilitate the kind of self-evaluation that would be required to have a change of heart.
We've given a lot of space over the years to the ongoing struggle, because it is a struggle. It's still in 2020, it's a struggle on questions of civil rights. But the thing that always comes back to me is, in so many ways, the demands of Black Americans are just so mundane. They don't seem to be outrageous. They're pretty mundane requests, aren't they?
Don't have the police kill us. That's not an unreasonable request. Yet that has become a huge political dividing line in this country. And so I think the real distinction here, and one of the reasons that we've seen such a gigantic response across the entire country, even huge responses in parts of the country where there are virtually no Black people, I think that people were not accustomed or not anticipating seeing a video that is 9 minutes long culminates in someone's death. It wasn't a snap decision. It wasn't someone who shot his gun in what he thought was a life or death situation and it turned out to be wrong. This was something that took a long time. It took a long time for Mr. Floyd to die. And so to ask that we not have that kind of egregious policing seems eminently reasonable. It seems like the most basic thing that one could ask, but it's far from certain that we'll be able to achieve that, at least not during this administration.
Yeah, and it's just important to point out that one of the reasons that George Floyd went to Minneapolis was as part of a church discipleship program. Yes, he'd had a tough life. Yes, he'd fallen in his life, but he actually went there to be part of a church discipleship program.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's just tragic. It's tragic all around.
What comes out of this, though, Jelani? Does anything positive come out of the violence? And yes, some of the violence is aimless, some of it is mindless, but does anything come out of this?
So here's where it gets a little touchy, and where what I have to say is maybe not the most uncontroversial thing, but there's a large portion of this country that cares much more about property and money than they do about people. And it's unfortunate, but those people may be made to think twice by the prospect of having uprisings and violence and loss of property. And that may lead them to be more amenable to just the most reasonable, basic social reform. It's uncomfortable. No one wants to see rioting happen. No one wants to see arson happen. I think that no reasonable moral person would rejoice at the sight of those things. But the fact of the matter is that one of the major reforms in the United States around housing came in 1968 after the riots that followed Martin Luther King's assassination. And this was purely because people who weren't moved by the moral pleas of the civil rights movement were certainly moved by material concerns. How do we prevent people from burning up the things that we own? That may be, for some people who don't understand humanity, that may be what gets them off the fence on this issue.
Jelani Cobb of The New Yorker. The death of George Floyd is tragically only part of a long history of US police killing unarmed Black people. But do the nationwide protests that we've seen suggest this is a breaking point for America? Anthea Butler of the University of Pennsylvania is one of America's leading theologians.
It's different because I think that it's since 2014 and the killing of Michael Brown, what we've had is an escalation in police killings here in the United States. But also what's on top of everything is a president who has been very, 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 very much in bed with white supremacists and has spoken white supremacist kind of thinking. And so when you have these two things coming together, it makes for a very difficult racial situation, more difficult than it already is in the United States.
Does the violence have a point?
I think the violence is twofold. One is the violence of people who may not be peaceful protesters, who may want to be agitators for various and sundry reasons, and there's a lot of that right now. But the violence on the point of the police and the military or the National Guard is about quelling dissent. It's about pushing back against people at a time where the whole protest is about violence in the first place that is unjustly and unfairly pushed towards African Americans during arrest and, you know, routine traffic stops.
Yeah. You and I have had the pleasure of talking many times, Anthea. It's usually been in the context of the civil rights movement, its foundation in nonviolence. But is there in any sense a righteous case for violence?
It depends on who you talk to. And I think that the righteous case for violence is one, if there is self-defense, obviously. And I think in some of these cases, and I hope that this doesn't happen this time, that, you know, when people have had to defend themselves against, you know, unjust violence, that may be something that gets used. I know that Dr. King always spoke about nonviolence because he studied the Hindu principles of Satyagraha. But I think in this particular case, if we leave the philosophy aside, leave all of this other stuff aside, what we've got right now in America is basically people who are marching in the midst of a pandemic to stand up against racism, and most of them don't have weapons, and we have a highly, highly weaponized police forces in this country. Some police forces even have tanks. So I think that if we're going to talk about violence, we have to talk about the violence that is perpetrated by over-militarized police forces in America.
The police force has also got its own ugly antecedents. I read a piece by Rashawn Ray for the Brookings Institution, which points out that many American police forces actually go back to slave patrols.
Exactly. You know, they kind of put it all together. You say slave patrols, there would have been a term in the South that they called paddy rollers. And essentially what those paddy rollers did was to look for runaway slaves to quell any kind of insurrection. People could hire them out at their plantations if they needed somebody to, you know, be worked over, let's say. So this is part of that. And I think right now we're not under a state of martial law yet, but lots of cities and state governments have put in curfews and things. I think it's been very difficult for police forces not to think that this militarization that they have could be used in lots of different ways. I mean, I think we could all agree if you looked at the video of what happened to George Floyd, that was excessive. It didn't make any sense whatsoever, and it was cruel and unusual.
When I think about that video of George Floyd and he's saying, "I can't breathe," he was being suffocated to death, and there's now a coroner's finding of homicide. But of course, it echoes the words of Eric Garner back in New York City in 2014. But in the words, "I can't breathe," is there a bigger statement there that the entire African-American community is sharing?
Yeah, none of us can breathe in a country that has continued to be racist, that has treated us indifferently, that has enslaved us, that has never apologized for it, that we've had to fight for our own freedom and appeal to the state. So in that sense of saying, "I can't breathe," we can't live. We can't breathe. We are being choked out. And we are being choked out by racism, whether that is the casual racism of a white woman in Central Park who believes that a black man shouldn't tell her what the rules are, or the racism of a police officer who decides that he'll just kneel on a man's neck until he dies for almost 9 minutes.
We inevitably talk about Trump and his incendiary language. Trump's language is not unique, or it's not original. Isn't it just a throwback to these governors and mayors who just spoke openly and glowingly about segregation and race mixing? He's just giving it the national pulpit, or indeed the international pulpit of the presidency.
You know, I tell people, I said, if, you know, basically 2020 right now is like 1968 if George Wallace won. That's it in a nutshell.
You mentioned Wallace there. One of the things that I recall reading was that in Dr. King's passionate argument for nonviolence, didn't he say that every time there's a riot, there's more votes for George Wallace?
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what Trump is trying to think about. He needs votes. He needs to make his base feel fear and that he's the only one that could take care of it. So that's part of what you see happening right now, is this play going on, or a reality TV show, as you might call it, that Trump needs to run in order to be able to try to win this 2020 election cycle.
History suggests he could be successful.
He could be, but I think he will destroy the nation if he is.
I was fascinated to read where the Chinese government was accusing the US of hypocrisy in the way that it's been dealing with the protesters, because they say, oh, America's been lecturing China on Hong Kong and their treatment of protesters. This seems to have an echo of the 1950s, where Dwight David Eisenhower, the US Republican president, he knew that he couldn't really keep railing against the Soviet Union for its lack of democracy when America didn't extend democracy to its African Americans. History just keeps replaying itself here.
Yes, it does. And it keeps replaying itself with somewhat of the same actors. Today, the Russian television showed all the protests and how the police were acting and, you know, basically said, look, they can't control people and they won't give African-Americans rights. And so this is why the nation has fallen apart, essentially. So, you know, whether it's Russia or China, either one of those, they have been used, have used this, the racism here, very effectively against the United States.
This is all happening in the context of mass lockdowns, but also agitation to constantly reopen the economy. How unequally has the coronavirus hit African American communities?
It hit African American communities terribly hard. You know, here in Philadelphia, we've had, out of the total population, 48% of African Americans have had the coronavirus. Those communities here were not tested early. They did not have access. Most of the people worked front-facing jobs that were essential workers, like grocery store workers, rapid transit employees, things like that. So they did not get to shelter in place, right? But I think now, to add to all of this, you have the displacement of over 40 million people out of jobs and out of work right now. It's not just Black people who will be suffering. It will be people all across the spectrum who won't have a job to go back to. They don't have adequate health care. They will probably be getting evicted from their homes after these kinds of rent restrictions are lifted at the end of June. I think that we're in for really big problems, and I don't think we have leadership that can solve them.
Anthea, am I being naive if I think that out of the kind of predicament that you've described, especially the mass unemployment, there could in fact be, if you like, a class-based unity that may come out of this?
I think so. I think there's going to be a tremendous backlash to the kind of looting, not the looting of stores that has been happening in the last few days, but the kind of, you know, continual looting of government programs, things that taxpayers pay into. There will be some kind of class-based solidarity and unity. And that may help with the racial divide, but it remains to be seen, because there are lots of factions and forces in this country that would like that not to happen. Because if it becomes about class in addition to race, then it becomes very problematic for a lot of people who would like to hold on to their wealth.
Even when the news is bad, it is always good to talk with you. Professor Anthea Butler of the University of Pennsylvania. She's one of America's leading theologians, also a historian of the civil rights movement. Anthea, as always, thank you so much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you so much.
And Anthea Butler has a book out next year on white evangelicals and racism. And you're with me, Andrew West.